Good morning. How's the sound? It's good? Okay. Feels a little bit echoey and loud to me. We can go down a little bit. Yeah, thanks, Bill. How's that? Oh, that feels a little bit better to me. How about you? Okay, not so blasting your ears. Well, welcome. Good morning, everybody. I'm Heidi Bourne. I've met many of you, and some of you we've not met. I live in Arcata, which is about 300 miles north of here, and sometimes I have the great privilege of getting to come teach this class when Sylvia or Donald can't be here. And as you all many know, that Sylvia's on sabbatical for the rest of this year, so I will be here a little bit more frequently, which is, again, a great privilege and pleasure for me to get to come practice with you. So I would love to know for whom this is your first time coming to Spirit Rock. Great. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Would you be willing to stand up, introduce yourself, tell me a little bit about why you chose to come? Anybody? Oh, great. And what is your name?
Diane.
Diane, welcome. Where's home?
New Jersey for now, but we're
Wow. So are you just in town for a short period of time? Thank you for coming. I'm glad you're here, Diane. Great. Who else? I know there were some hands over here. Tell me your
name.
Way to go, Mom. That's great. Where did you come from?
Berkeley.
Well, good. So a family outing? That's great. Good for you. Have you been here before?
I have. Once.
Great. Did it take much arm twisting?
Not much.
That's great. That's great. Well, welcome. Can you each say your names?
I'm Levi.
Levi. Judy?
Dahlia.
Dahlia.
Woody?
Well, welcome. Thank you for being here. Who else? Anybody else? This is your first time? The veteran crew. How sweet. How nice. Well, welcome. I'm really glad you're here. It's tradition in this gathering on Wednesday morning to turn to somebody close to you and introduce yourself. And I would like to insert a little bit of a new tradition into this gathering that I think is a lot of fun, and it's a way that I like to often begin my own classes when I teach, which is to just take a moment. I'm a big fan of arriving meditation. To just take a very short period of time, and I'll let you know, it might be just a minute of just going inside and settling into your own body, settling into this time and place, letting yourself land. And bringing to mind something that is uplifting for you. Maybe something that happened recently that gave you confidence, a certain sense of buoyancy, uplift. Just made you feel good. And it doesn't have to be anything huge. Can just be the smallest little piece. And then open your eyes, come back. And then turn to somebody nearby and certainly introduce yourself. Please tell this person your name. And then share, what is this thing that you thought of that you find uplifting? And it can just be a conversation. We don't have to do this in the way of one person shares, the other person listens, but we will share and listen. But just talk with each other for the next couple of minutes about this. And go ahead. And if you don't have a partner, just join in anywhere. And begin to wrap it up. So glad you're here. Okay. Coming back into the room and into your chair, getting settled. Isn't this fun? Obviously it is. This is good. How do you feel? A little uplifted. So here's why I love that practice, and I probably don't even need to tell you why, because you just found out. It's wonderful to say hello to somebody, to introduce yourself, but when you share a piece of yourself, then there's a deeper connection. You're actually connecting on something that matters to you. But when we share something that is uplifting with each other, we are stimulating the mirror neurons that we have wired into us, so we pick up on each other's energy and we feel good, right? Don't you feel a little bit physically uplifted by hearing what somebody else's joy is? And even if in that moment, maybe we're having a hard day, it could be that we're not asking for false happiness, false joy, false uplift. But even when we can hear what is nurturing and brings joy to another person, we get a vicarious hit. And that stimulates that place in the brain that helps us with feelings of well-being. It's a really beautiful way to set up a morning of meditation. It just sweetens the pie a little bit. And truly, it doesn't ask us to be other than we are, but it just shows that even if we're having a rough morning, we are more than the rough morning. We have these other parts of ourselves. So do you like that? I love that practice. So we will continue to do that when I'm here in different iterations, and you can certainly take it and do it yourself. You know, if you go to lunch with a friend or you see somebody, and before we tend to dive in and talk about our big challenges, but if we can also include these places that support us, it's great. It just feels good. and it's nice to know what uplifts another person, especially somebody who we know. And taking the time to check in with, and now how does that feel after we do it? What we're doing is letting it soak. When you actually know, oh, this is how it feels. I just feel a little lighter, or maybe fluttery, or just however you manage, however you feel that physically, when you note it, it becomes really functional to bring that back when you need it. You might be having a rough day, and then you can come back to, oh, that morning at Spirit Rock on Wednesday morning when we just took 2 minutes to share something joyful, that was a good moment in my week. And that stimulates again that place in the brain that helps us feel feelings of well-being. So that's why we do it also. The last time I was here, 2 weeks ago, we started an exploration of joy. And I'm kind of on that kick right now. I am really enjoying exploring different aspects of joy as they show up in my life, and to see how it works. And when I'm talking about joy, I don't mean Hallmark happiness. I really don't. I mean just these moments of okayness, moments of contentment, lots of ways to define joy. So just as a quick recap on 2 weeks ago for those who weren't here, or just as a reminder, what's really interesting from the perspective of the Dharma is that there are four aspects of joy, or four kinds of Dharma joys. And the first one is this sense of peace and well-being that we feel in meditative states. So hopefully you've all had the experience of sitting in meditation and getting a feeling of ease, or the meditation is over and you say, oh, I feel better. I'm more settled. Or it could be very intense moments in a meditation itself that feel rapturous and this intense energy comes up. That's also quite normal. It's part of what happens with the concentrated mind. So that is called meditative joy. The second aspect of Dharma joy is the joy of realization. And this is what we're going to talk mostly about today. And the joy of realization are these aha moments when we know or understand something a little more deeply. You know what I'm talking about? You know, like it could be something that you've heard many, many times, and then it goes in, and you go, I get it. That is a joyful moment. There's something that opens up for us. Perspective opens up. Sayadaw Utejaniya, who was a very important and influential Theravadan Buddhist monk, meditation master, he says, you should be happy when you know or understand anything. You should be happy when you know or understand anything. Can we just take that in? Oh, wow, I got it. I understand. Or can you remember a long time ago learning algebra or some kind of math that felt so inaccessible, and then something clicks and you see it, you get it? That's a joyful moment. We want to take those in because they cultivate confidence. They cultivate perspective. We have this ability to say, oh, I can do this. Oh, I can learn. It feels really good. Deeper understanding. The third kind of Dharma joy is the joy, the contentment, the ease that we feel through cultivating ethical action, our ethical conduct. Continual commitment and practice to cultivate non-harming and to study non-harming in ourselves, non-harming of ourselves, non-harming of others. That brings a quality of ease and satisfaction and joy when we know that we are living our lives, or we just had an hour in which we dealt with something difficult, but we did it in line with our values in a way that cultivated more ease, more peace, more kindness for ourselves and another. And truly, in difficult situations, when we can approach a difficult situation and we might have a lot of mind clench about it, but we actually know acting out of reactivity is going to cause more harm, and we dig a little deeper and we ask ourselves, all right, what's the best way to deal with this? How can I work with this in a kind, effective way? And we do, and it comes out of our commitment to ethical action. That is a source of joy. So that's the third Dharma joy. And the fourth Dharma joy that we spoke extensively about 2 weeks ago was mudita, appreciative joy, vicarious joy, sympathetic joy, which is the capacity to really feel happiness and rejoice for somebody else's great good fortune, happiness, or joy, that it's not about us. So those are the four. And I'd like to, like I said, we will focus on the second one in a little while, the joy of realization. But I would like to take another pause before we go into our longer sit. And we're going to do a similar thing that we just did with what uplifts us, bringing to mind something you've realized lately. Something might be small, might be large, something that broadened your perspective, that gave you more capacity. Because I think in these aha moments, when we learn a little bit more, we gain depth, we gain capacity, our resiliency grows because we get a wider perspective. And I think that this is very connected to equanimity. When we get perspective, when we have deeper awareness, it bolsters us. It expands our ability to flex, to work with whatever there is, equanimity. So let's just go inside for a moment. And bringing to mind something you've learned lately, large or small, that expanded your perspective, that was a bit of an aha. And as you bring this to mind, see if there is any reverberation or a correlate to this in your body. And then come back. Would anybody be willing to share what came to mind and how that may have felt? We won't take a long time to do this, but I would love to hear from one or two people. I know this is a quick exercise. Anybody? Yeah. Yeah. Linda.
It just feels like an expansion of energy.
Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Did you all hear that? An expansion of space, an aha that expanded out. Anybody else relate to that? I can relate to that. That's how it feels to me, that aha of understanding. There's a relaxation that comes. There's an opening of spaciousness, not holding so tightly. Anybody else willing to say? Yes, Woody. Yes, thank you.
Hello? Can you hear me? This moment is not the last. There are more moments. And that the moment that I'm experiencing, there's actually another one right next to it.
Yeah.
And that gives me space. It's kind of a notion. It kind of is in a time frame sense.
Exactly. So isn't that amazing? When we get that deeper realization of, it's just this moment, and now there's another one, and now there's another one. It expands our capacity. We don't have to hold this one so tightly. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so this is the direction that we're going, is to start seeing and feeling, number one, the sense of ease and joy, uplift, It is also expansive. It connects us with one another. And the joy that comes out, the aha, the realization, can do the same thing. So I think all of these aspects of Dharma joy bring us into this expanded sense of self, holding things less tightly. And out of that, so much learning can happen, so much capacity, so much resiliency and love. And everything comes out of a little more spaciousness when we feel that. So we'll sit now. And we'll sit for about 25 minutes-ish or so. Settling into our bodies just as they are. Finding a comfortable posture. And holding just enough energy in the spine to stay upright and alert. And this quality of uprightness doesn't have to be literally upright. You might be lying down, but there's still a quality of energy coming up the spine, keeping the mind present, a bright mind. And within this upright energy, we allow the whole body to soften and relax. Just relax. Especially the front body, the belly and the chest and the shoulders, the face and the throat, even the arms and the hands. And in this softening, we make room to breathe. And as we turn our awareness inward, sensing the breath, wherever it's most obvious to you, might be the belly, the chest, maybe how the air goes in and out of the nostrils. Wherever you feel your breath the most is just right. And if the breath doesn't seem to be the place where you can settle your awareness, you might choose the hands, the feet, the places the body is touching the chair or the floor. And for the next bit of time, know that there's nothing to do, there's nowhere to go. We relax into the breath or the body, sensing it from the inside out with the quality of inhabiting. Inhabiting this moment and this time in a gentle, kind way. And when the mind wanders off and you know it, again gently come back and begin again. as we continue to sit quietly for a little bit longer, we'll move our practice into the heart, the practice of metta, loving kindness and compassion. And we'll begin by sensing our own hearts, dropping the awareness down into the heart center. Take a few breaths. You might even imagine breathing into the heart from all directions, in front and the back of the heart, side to side, above and below, from all the diagonals, breathing in fresh air into the heart, to every aspect of the heart. And as you breathing out into all directions again, allowing the heart to become more spacious and expansive, a little softer. And as we breathe with this heart's breath, in and out from all directions and into all directions, the heart's capacity grows. See if you can feel that. And out of this soft, spacious, stable heart, we start to send out some blessings of goodwill. If you'd like to bring to mind a being who is very dear to you, might be a mentor or an elder, or even a pet, and offer the goodness of your heart to theirs. It might be in phrases like, may you feel safe, may you feel peaceful, may you feel healthy, may you be at ease. Might be phrases like that, or maybe it's more a sense of radiating this metta, this warmth, this friendliness to this other being's heart. Wordlessly. And as you picture them receiving your blessings, your goodwill, they in turn send the same blessings back to you, either in phrases or radiating metta from their heart to yours. Maybe you can feel that. And maybe you've learned something very deep, something very important from this being that has been a great joy to you, the joy of being seen and also the joy of learning and understanding from this being. And then we offer ourselves these same blessings, whether it's the phrases of wishing ourselves well or just tapping in energetically to our own good hearts with a sense of an inner bow of gratitude and care and love for ourselves. And if there's anybody else that comes to mind for whom you'd like to send out a blessing of care, do that silently. Imagine this being and send that out. And as is traditional in this Wednesday morning gathering, we will also send these prayers out loud. I'm thinking of my mom, who is struggling with a respiratory illness. May she feel better soon. Who are you thinking of?
Fractured hip and a lacerated liver, and is scheduled to be put down today at 3:30, and it's extremely difficult, so barring a miracle, that is what's slated to happen, and it's just devastating. So sending metta to her and to her daughter.
I'm thinking of my sister-in-law, Sandy, who passed away this past Sunday after a long, long and I'm thinking of my brother Joe, who was her caregiver, and the relief
though we hold each other's joys and sorrows in this space of metta, compassion, loving awareness, I want to offer you a poem on the joy of realization. This is entitled, Why I Love Being Married to a Chemist. Because he can still cause a reaction in me when he talks about SN2 displacements, amines and esters looking for receptor sites at the base of their ketones, because he lugs home serious tomes like the Journal of the American Chemical Society or the Proceedings of the Society of Plastics Industry, the opposite of the slim volumes of poetry with colored covers that fill my bookshelves, because once, years ago, on a Saturday before our raucous sun rang in the dawn, he was just standing there in the bathroom out of the shower. I said, honey, what's wrong? And he said, oh, I was just thinking about a molecule. Because he taught me about sublimation, how a solid like ice can change straight to a gas without becoming liquid first. Because even after all this time, he can still make me melt. So we're going to take a 10-minute break, but before we do, we have some announcements. Thank you. We will reconvene in 10 minutes. No. Did you like that poem?
Yes.
You want to hear it again?
No.
No? Could anybody relate?
Yes.
I loved it. All right. I hope that you had an enjoyable sit and a nice break. And here we are, and we're going to dive into the topic of the joy of realization. What happens when we really learn something, that aha moment? Or the other title of this talk is Tacos and Lemonade. And you'll find out. So one of the things that I do that some of you know about is that in the spring to fall season, I like to lead wilderness retreats. And they're typically retreats that are pretty active, river rafting and hiking. And sometimes they're moving retreats, so we're backpacking and on a river we're moving. And sometimes we base out of a center and do day hikes. But it's something that I really love to do, and I do it because I think that there's a very profound and magical experience about bringing contemplative practice into the natural environment and really connecting deeply with the earth, and also it challenges us in ways when we don't have a structure around us, a meditation hall, a dining hall, a residence hall, that we really are challenged to dig a little deeper and find this quality of capacity and perspective that I'm talking about this morning. So when I prepare for these retreats and start thinking about what I hope for in them and where I want to go with them, I do check my own motivation and intention. What is it that I'm doing? Why am I doing this? And I think it's a really important check for us all with whatever we're doing. Why am I doing what I'm doing? And what is the volition? What is that thing that drives motivation? And then how do we stay on course? What is the intention? And I find that there are several teachings from the Buddha that have been enormously important for me that show up as guides, as support, and I want to offer these teachings to you and just, you know, see how they land for you, and then we'll talk a little bit more. I'll tell you more about the retreats that I've done over the last few months and how these teachings have shown up. And if you've sat with me before, as I know many of you have, I tend to bring in the same teachings because I think that some of them are so timeless. So my sense is you've heard some of this before. The first one from the Buddha, protecting myself, I protect others. Protecting others, I protect myself. Have you heard that? So let's talk about that again. Protecting myself, I protect others. Protecting others, I protect myself. So we can talk about that. There are lots of ways to unpack that. And one of a bigger way to look at it is when we take up the practices of ethical conduct, of non-harming, we are, in essence, protecting ourselves by how we protect our bodies, how we protect our minds and our speech through what we do, but it has a very real, tangible ripple effect, right, on how our own behavior affects another. So the more we cultivate non-harming in ourselves, that supports and cultivates an environment of safety for others. So that's one way that this teaching really shows up in what it's pointing to. In a very everyday practical way, we could compare it to, or we could take in that we all have an accepted set of guidelines for driving. If we all abide to the same driving rules, pretty much we stay safe. And then as soon as somebody runs a red light, we're not safe. And so we see how one thing can screw the whole thing up, and how important it is that we actually are very aware that what we do matters, and the things that we put in place to care for and protect ourselves go way beyond ourselves. So that's the first one that I find shows up for me over and over again in my life. The second one is a question, it's a reflection question again that comes from the Buddha that says, what when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? What when I do it will be for my long-term welfare and happiness? So this is not a selfish question. This is a question that is a deeper reflection question, especially if we are grappling with some big decision. And we want to be careful with the decision. And so this encourages us to take the long view. And you know, we don't have to take the long view with everything that we do. If you want to go get an ice cream, go get an ice cream. But, and I say that in jest because it's important to hold things lightly too. We don't have to take everything so seriously. But that long-term view question is a compass question that can be extraordinarily helpful. And so what I think about when I'm bringing groups into the wilderness, putting in place things that keep us safe, understanding why I am doing this, knowing that there is some inherent risk in being out in the wilderness. There just is, and there's inherent risk in crossing the street. And I'm not minimizing either one, but those questions, these teachings become real. And so these are not just something that is, these teachings are not academic, they're actually quite experiential. And then we've heard many times from many teachers, certainly from Sylvia, the experience of when things are difficult or challenging or surprising, that adage that says, this is what's happening now. Right now, it's like this. And I think probably many of us have heard that. And it's important when you hear teachings or pithy pieces like this, they can sound great. And you go, oh yeah, that makes a lot of sense. But how do they actually function in our lives when you really have to say, right now, it's like this. What am I going to do about it? Or is there anything for me to do about it? Can we be with the experience of perhaps the deep discomfort of right now, it's like this? And then how this relates to the joy of realization, the awareness, understanding, getting new knowledge, is that right now it's like this. Says, yeah, I'm understanding what it's like right here. It expands our capacity, expands our perspective. And then that connects us to the equanimity that Gil Fronsdahl has given us the phrase that says, let's see what happens next. Right now it's like this. Let's see what happens next. That takes a lot of discipline, doesn't it? This takes the capacity to truly do what our practice trains us to do, which is to turn towards what is difficult, to be able to tolerate discomfort. And then one more teaching that I find extremely supportive in this comes from Suzuki Roshi. And the story is that one of his students comes to him and says, please, please, tell me what is the most important thing? And Suzuki Roshi says, to find out what is the most important thing. Oh, so Zen, right? Because that's not the answer we were looking for. We want to know what is the most important thing. So we get to that process of discovery through various teachings that speak to us. And so for me, protecting myself, I protect others. Protecting others, I protect myself. What, when I do it, will be for my long-term welfare and happiness. And not just mine, yours, ours. Right now, it's like this. Let's see what happens next. And what is the most important thing? How do I get to what is most necessary now? What is that process? So this is a feedback loop. We can take each of these teachings and see how they are mutually interdependent. So when I teach these retreats, and I want to integrate these teachings into them, there's another question that comes up, and that is, okay, how are we going to get there? These are beautiful teachings, and they're foundational, and they're very supportive. But again, we can hear these teachings and think they sound really good, and they do. But we want to know how we're going to implement that. Like, what is the practical application of these things really showing up? So then I turn towards Pema Chodron. And Pema offers us this beautiful three-part framework that I think is for living our lives, but I like to integrate this in the wilderness. The first is be fully present. The second, feel your heart. And the third, engage the next moment without an agenda. Pretty hard, right? Engage the next moment without an agenda. So this is where we start. And we start with be fully present. And this is not just for wilderness retreats. This is for our lives, right? This is our teaching over and over and over again. How do we come into full presence to really experience our lives? We do it through many ways. One way is very elemental. You know, every time we sit down and we start taking in our experience through our senses, through what we hear, what we see, what we smell, what we touch, what we taste, and even the quality of the thinking mind. These are all doorways into becoming present. And when we're outside, we're typically very aware of the elements. Is it cold? Is it hot? Is this rocky? Is it soft? What is the quality of the earth? If you're on a river, it's moving, and the externals are changing all the time, and there are so many unknowns. So we're brought right into the quality of our experience of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, continually, when we're not in a building necessarily. But these are all ways of becoming fully present. And again, you don't have to be outside on a wilderness retreat to sense these ways of becoming present. So elements, the sense of water, the sense of temperature, the sense of touch, all of that. And then what is the state of mind? What is the quality of mind? And can we stay curious? Can we stay aware? We start noticing the thinking mind, the experience, the internal experience and the external experience. So being fully present requires a quality of expansive awareness so we can experience the full range of being alive, of our emotions, of our bodies, of what's happening internally and externally. So I want to read you a piece. This comes from K. Kate Lila Wheeler, one of the Dharma teachers here at Spirit Rock and at IMS. This is called Appreciating Your Aliveness. We only get one body in this life, the one we are each endowed with right in this moment. Begin by giving yours the respect it deserves. Did you realize every atom in it is 14.5 billion years old? All bodies are part of matter created at the Big Bang 10 billion years before the Earth appeared. Yes, your overall body is composed of about 7 octillion venerable atoms. That's 7 with 27 zeros after it, mostly produced by exploding stars. You are literally stardust, and so is everything around you. The water in this body seems to flow into your mouth from a fountain or a glass and then out again through pores and orifices. But like all the waters of the earth, no one knows where it came from. Perhaps a comet's tail, it said. And if you have gold fillings, your teeth carry a share of all the gold that exists in the universe, for the number of gold molecules is finite. Your body is not just mineral and elemental. No, it's vividly alive. Anyone who knows, who's ever danced, had a sore throat, made love, or stubbed a toe. Try to sense the skin around your body. Feel how alive it is. For this, you can thank a single-celled creature. All the Baroque variety of life on Earth is considered to come from a common tiny ancestor who appeared about 4 billion years ago. Again, no one knows quite how. And still today, on a cellular level, basic functions like respiration look similar in plants and animals. So does our DNA. We humans share about half of our genetic information with plants. We truly aren't very far away from anything. Our salty blood remembers oceanic origins. The structure of our spines and ribs was first developed by fish. Population geneticists agree that all of us are literally one human family. What would our world be like if everyone acted on this truth? Yet as connected as we are, there is astonishing diversity even within being human. Each person is utterly distinct. Our fingerprints, toe prints, and tongue prints will never be reproduced. But surely it's the brain that is our most fabulous body part. Scientists believe the human brain is the most complex object in the universe, capable of making 100 trillion neural connections. Lay all your neurons end to end, and they'll reach to the moon and back. Awake, asleep, or dreaming, your brain is active night and day, a magic lantern. Its neurons interact in constantly shifting patterns of electrical energy and are deeply attuned to others and the outside world. Not only that, but your brain is capable of self-awareness. Brain and body are inseparable collaborators, producing the symphony that fully absorbs us. This is the wonder of a life. How amazing that we can be amazed. It's beautiful. So when we come into this kind of depth of awareness of our connection of our body to the earth and everything that is around us, we can become very, very fully present. And we don't often think of ourselves at that level. We're just going around in our lives. But we get very connected to the elements and being fully present when we're challenged, right? You know, we go through our lives when it's just hunky-dory, it's going just fine, and then something happens that makes it difficult. So the first, earlier in May, I did a trip on the Yampa River, and the Yampa River is in northeastern Utah. It starts actually, it's in northwestern Colorado, and it runs east-west into Utah through Dinosaur National Monument. And it's extremely beautiful. And the Yampa is one of the last, I think it is the last free-flowing tributary of the Colorado River system, which means it's not dammed. And there's no control over it. You know, its depth and its volume and its speed are a result of snowmelt. So it was a big snow year in Colorado. So the river was going and Last year when I did this trip, we had perfect weather. It was beautiful. It was 70 degrees every single day. And so we did this trip again. And this year, it was freezing cold. And it rained every day. And Linda was there. And you know, it was cold. And so we were very aware of the elements. We were very aware of our bodies. And we became very in tune with shivering. And I mean that seriously. Like, what was the experience of shivering? And to find ways to keep the core warm, but the feet or the hands, in my experience, my feet and hands were really cold. My core was okay. And to know that it was going to be like that for 5 days. And how do we manage staying fully present within knowing that adversity was going to go on? And we had 2 afternoons where the sun shone, that we had a couple of great hikes, and it was in those moments that the sun came out, thank God. And we had 1 evening that was a full moon. It was beautiful. But how do we manage ourselves? And so this piece of being fully present isn't always so comfortable, is it? It's easier to check out. But when you're outside and you need to keep yourself safe and stable, you're very, very present. So that's the first one. Number 2, feel your heart. So when you think about that, you know, feel your heart. Just take a moment. What does that mean to you? You drop into the heart, hopefully with some compassion, some love, some patience, some kindness, some ability to say, oh my God, I am so cold, and also not to fight it. This ability to be with the struggle with a bit of allowing and kindness, and to see that everybody on the trip was freezing. It wasn't just me. And so we tap into this common humanity of compassion. This is my current favorite definition of compassion. This comes from Rachel Naomi Raymond, a local physician who does work with cancer. Compassion begins with the acceptance of what is most human in ourselves, what is most capable of suffering. In attending to our own capacity to suffer, we can uncover a simple and profound connection between our own vulnerability and the vulnerability in all others. Experiencing this allows us to find an instinctive kindness towards life, which is the foundation of all compassion. When we really connect with our own suffering between each other, ultimately our own pain and difficulty and struggle becomes diluted or mixed inside the collective pain, the collective difficulty. Are you with me on that? And so when we recognize we're all really cold here, it lightened it up, because we were all really cold, and okay, this is what cold is like. Can we touch into that place of this instinctive kindness? And I think that's really what compassion is an instinctive kindness when we connect with one another. And then we go into that experience of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. Oh, this is unpleasant. How can we find what is beautiful within the struggle? And there were a lot of beautiful moments, weren't there? I mean, it was, you know, when you can be in an extraordinary place and be deeply uncomfortable, the experience of deeply uncomfortable can soften, and it can just spread out, and we don't have to be so caught in our own experience of, I'm freezing cold, because there's nothing to do about it except put on layers, but it's how it is. So I'm just using this as an example of sometimes right now, and right now might be a week, it's like this. And we find our way within that. Can we stay open and curious? Can we be notice these places of resistance of the judgmental mind. Why the hell did she schedule a trip in the middle of May? What was she thinking? Well, she was thinking it was perfect last year, and this year it's not. That's what she was thinking. And we're there anyway. So can we bring an attitude of willingness and care and flexibility and tolerance and all of that? The compassion, the warmth, the expansiveness. And mostly, I think, what is so important in feeling our hearts when things are difficult is also to notice what is beautiful. To notice what is good, to notice what is okay around us is critical for balancing the negativity bias in the brain that says something, there's always a tiger that's going to come out and eat me. This is terrible. It's never going to get better. Well, if you look around and you see these rock walls that are over a billion years old and recognize that the weather has been changing in this canyon for over a billion years or more, and we're all still here, and it is still here. It gives us, again, this capacity. It gives us perspective, the joy of realization, of deeper understanding. This is feeling our hearts. And here's a short piece from Mark Coleman's book, Awake in the Wild. While doing standing meditation with my eyes closed in the forest, I noticed a tickle on my face. It traveled repeatedly from my mouth to my right eye and back again over a period of about 10 minutes. Practicing non-reactivity, I breathed patiently, sensing many light legs busy walking back and forth. After some time, a new strange sensation appeared on my mouth, like it was being covered. Curiosity got the better of me and I opened my eyes. A small spider had woven a delicate web over my mouth and secured its gossamer thread on an eyelash. I felt an exquisite intimacy with this being. I felt touched at being considered part of nature, suitable to make a home on. And yet at the same time, I knew I would shatter its home and our intimacy when I opened my mouth. What intimacy, delicacy, and destruction. A touch of grace as delicate as a spider's thread. Isn't this what our lives are like? Intimacy and delicacy, birth and death and destruction. And it is, we are just hanging on this little thread. So when we are caught in how uncomfortable we might be, self-pity and victimhood, it's so much better to try to get outside of that. And it doesn't mean that we're not uncomfortable at times. We are, but we use these bigger teachings to help hold us. So on this same trip, this trip includes hiking. And what I love about being an ancient river is that there are often just breathtaking side canyons. Canyons that meander and go up that are full of rock formations and just extraordinary, extraordinary life, and get into places that you could not normally or otherwise get to unless you're taking a trail a long way or you're on a river and you can get to these wild places. So we were on this beautiful hike and up this canyon, and the walls were amazing, and it was one of the two afternoons that the sun came out, and it changed everybody's attitude immediately, because you know how that is when you're freezing cold and the sun comes out and you get warm. All of a sudden, the weight lifts, you know, we lighten up and we feel better internally because we are not so challenged to stay warm. And it was also beautiful out. So there were a number of us, and we were with an organization that, a river guide organization, so the guides were walking with us, and there were some people, they were spread out. We were spread out on this trail. Some people were down below, some people were in the middle area. I was up above with the last group, because the other thing we do on these trips is we have silent hiking, and silent hiking is really an extraordinary experience, and I encourage that a lot. If when you go for a walk, don't plug your ears in to listen to something. Just go out and walk and enjoy that experience. So I was with the group that wanted to hike down silently. And one of the things that we do is if you need to communicate going up the trail, you need to let somebody know, you send a message up the trail. So there were half a dozen of us or so up at the top and making our way back to camp down the trail, and all of a sudden we got the message that somebody had fallen. It was an emergency, and we needed to send the message up to where I was because there were a couple of guides with me and the few other people that were up there. And so you get the message, okay, somebody fell, there's an emergency. And immediately, you know, there's some fear that comes up. What happened? Who was it? Is he or she okay? So turned out that we were hiking on this fairly narrow pathway, and the terrain was like this mix of sand and dirt, so it can be a little bit slippery. And on the one side of the trail over here was just this rock wall because we were meandering down this, basically the side of this canyon, this cliff-ish. And the path was probably 20 inches wide or so, not that wide. And somebody just slipped. He just purely slipped on the edge and went down a fairly long distance on a steep slope. And right next to him was hiking one of the guides who, by some unbelievable ability, I didn't see this happen, but as this person was tumbling down, what was reported to me is that this guide literally flew over the top of this person, landed about 30 yards down there, and arrested his fall. And he literally saved his life, because had he continued to go, there was then a cliff, and it would have been a really different situation. So what then ensued was all of these river guides, they're all wilderness first responders, and they have all of the emergency tools that they need in a situation like this, and they just went to work. And it was really beautiful, because once I saw that the person who fell was okay, I knew he didn't hit his head and he was completely lucid and he was in pain. And the end of the story is he did have a compression fracture in one of his vertebrae, and he's doing great now. But my point is, in that moment, everything comes up, right? Fear comes up, and you want to have trained people who know how to respond very quickly and effectively and professionally. And it's exactly what happened. And, you know, somebody ran down to the camp and there's a satellite phone. And when you call the park service on a satellite phone, the coordinates come right through. And within 2 hours, there was a helicopter there and he was flown out. And we went back to camp and we did a lot of body scan. We did a lot of metta and a lot of being fully present and a lot of feeling our hearts, because that's what happens. So when push comes to shove, when difficulty happens, we can rely on these practices to show up. And we do this in community. And the people who saw it, it was difficult because they saw it, but he was actually okay. And he really was. And to see how the roles we take within the groups with which we are connected, that every person's actions really matter when we all bring our skills to whatever the situation is, it doesn't have to be a disaster. And part of what we are doing in cultivating these skills in our practice is to know how to manage when these really difficult things happen. So by caring for ourselves, we care for others. By caring for others, we're caring for ourselves. So this teaching about protecting ourselves and protecting others comes right down to what are the skills that are present in the room for what we need, for what we are taking on. So this is a practical application of how these teachings really do show up in the kinds of activities that we get involved in. All right, third one, engage the next moment without an agenda. I think this is actually the hardest one. Would you agree? Yeah. Because most of us have an agenda, or we have goals. We want to see certain things happen, and we're not necessarily in control. This is another thing that our practice teaches us. Every single time we sit down and we're just quiet with the breath. And then the mind goes to some crazy place. We're not in control of this mind, right? And then we bring it back over and over again with this quality of cultivating steadiness. But right now it's like this. Let's see what happens next. This is engage the next moment without an agenda. This comes from Gavin Harrison, another Dharma teacher. Awareness meditation is a way of opening our attention to the truth of what is present. We do not selectively pay attention to pleasant things and ignore the unpleasant. We open choicelessly to what is positive and joyous as much as to the suffering that we find. Meeting each moment without resistance, we discover unsuspected beauty in our hearts and minds and bodies and in the world around us. We sense the uniqueness of each fleeting breath. We perceive the movement of nature within us. We feel sad without needing to justify or eliminate the emotion. And we feel happy without needing to believe that we will never again know sadness. This is the way of meditation. This is also our lives. This is what is going on. So what I will go back to that story of the hiking accident. After we all got back to camp, we built a fire, and one of the guides had made dinner for us. So when we all got back, dinner was ready, and there was a fire, and it was beautiful. And it was the one evening that it didn't rain, and it was a full moon. And the moonlight was reflecting off the canyon wall on the other side of the river. So, and it was just stunning. And so even within the fear, the sadness, the grief, the loss, the trip was completely changed in that moment because of this accident, there's still beauty. It's so important to recognize that. Okay, next story. So a few weeks ago, I led a different trip that was a hut-to-hut hiking retreat in southwestern Colorado in the San Juan Mountains. Anybody been to the San Juans? You know how beautiful it is. So this is a hike that goes from above Telluride to Ouray, and it's, the elevation is between about 9 and 11,000 feet on this hike, and there's a series of huts. So it's lightweight backpacking. It's 5 days over 4 nights, about 35 miles, and there were 8 of us. And this was a women's hiking retreat, and I had hired a nutritionist who was also a chef who designed all of the meals and cooked them all ahead of time and dehydrated them. So we were just carrying our personal gear and this amazing food. And this same chef was also a former river guide and with huge amounts of wilderness experience. So that's the other thing I do, is try to partner with other people so I'm not the only one. So we have skilled, knowledgeable people. And beautiful, beautiful hike. The San Juans, because this time of year, because it was an extremely big snow year, everything was lush. The wildflowers were just extravagant, and the streams were full, and we hiked from hut to hut, and it was very, very beautiful. Third day out, 5 days, 4 nights. Third day out, we were walking or hiking in the morning, and we were not a fast group at all. We definitely took our time. And Nicole, who is the cook and the other experienced wilderness person, she would hike at the front of the group, and I hiked at the back of the group. So I was always the last to get to wherever we were getting to, which is my choice. It was fine. So I could see that we were getting up to a creek crossing, and that she was walking up and down the bank looking for an appropriate place to cross. And there was this big downed tree going across this creek that had a lot of pokey things coming out of it. And those pokey things were the remnants of broken branches. And the stream there was big. It was really rushing. And there were boulders and obstacles, and the top of this tree, which is where one might naturally think you would cross, was pretty wet and might have been a little slimy, because when wood is wet for a while, it can get really slippery because some moss grows on it. And there was a place upstream also that could have been walked through that wasn't all that deep, maybe about, I don't know, 8 inches deep or so. But even within that, there can be very slippery rocks. So we got to this stream crossing, and it was late morning, and Nicole came over to me and she said, "You are the trip leader, but we're not doing this, and we're going to have to abort." I said, "Wait, say that again." She said, "You are the trip leader, and that's a class 5 rapid right after that tree. If anybody falls off, we're in trouble. We have a catastrophic event that's going to happen, so we're going to abort. But it's your decision." That's the kind of person I want to partner with. The person who's going to say, "We're not doing this, and this is why. And I totally trust that decision. Okay, let's see what happens next." Right? Be fully present. Feel your heart. Engage the next moment without an agenda. I had a big agenda. You know, the agenda was this hike, and we had to get to where we were going, and we couldn't backtrack because there are scheduled groups coming through this hike, through these huts each night. So now what are we going to do? We happened to be at the one place on the hike where we could backtrack on the trail and get to a parking lot, because there was another trail that took off there that people would come up and do day hikes. So I knew we were about 12 miles from town, from that parking lot. So we hiked back there, and I ended up hitching a ride with a couple that was coming off of another hike, and we went into town with another member of our group to go back to the outfit that runs these huts, and I knew I could get back there. So we got a ride. We went to the hut office and said, "Here's the problem. We're stuck in this parking lot. We need a reroute, or we need to backtrack. What can you do to help us? Because we're halfway through our trip and there are all these other people. The rest of our trip is waiting there." And they were great. They said, "Okay, we actually do have a reroute." And one of their other shuttle drivers just happened to walk in at that moment. And they were able to drive us to another trailhead that was going to get us to the same hut that we were going to anyway, but from a different direction. So that was amazing, you know, that we showed up, we said, "We got a problem, how can we fix this problem?" So this driver went back to pick everybody up, and in the meantime, the other person that I was with, it was really hot out, we went to the corner restaurant and had tacos and lemonade. They were really good grilled portobello tacos and fresh lemonade, and it was like 100 degrees out. It was great. So we had tacos and lemonade. We felt great, and then we bought tacos and lemonade for everybody else. So when they got to pick us up to take us, we were able to deliver the tacos and lemonade, and somebody said, "Oh my God, you made lemonade out of the lemons." You know? And then we were able to reroute, and we got on the trail, and we got to the hut pretty late, and we were pretty tired, but we were there. And it took being fully present, feeling our hearts, and really being willing to say, "What is the next best move? How are we going to work with this?" Because I think what's really true, not just in wilderness retreats or being outside, is that our practice is supporting us to create a pliancy and nimbleness of mind. Not to be so tight with how we think things should be by not holding to fixed views, right? In the Metta Sutta, the pure-hearted one is released. So when we have broad enough capacity, can widen out the perspective and get the big picture and not be so wedded to how it has to be, we recalibrate, we accommodate, we acclimate. And then we remember we can do hard things. this is important piece here, is that none of this is necessarily easy. Some things are easier than others, but we can do this stuff. And that is life-affirming. That gives us the confidence and the motivation to move into the next thing that is difficult. The impending loss of a pet, of a person, we can apply all of these things to all of these situations. Being willing to be fully present, being willing to feel what's really here, and trying to get a big enough view so we're not in pigeonholed. So that's what I have for you. Let's talk with each other. Any kind of comments or questions? And we have a couple of mics that can go around. Yeah, Linda. Let's wait for the mic. Thanks. I don't think it's on.
Is this one on?
Yes. Yeah.
Now I feel like I have to say something really important. Yeah, I was really appreciated your talk today, and having been on the first Yampa River trip, I brought tears to my eyes thinking about Sam jumping off that cliff and just trusting whatever that he was going to be able to accomplish what he wanted to.
Did you see it?
A miracle, no.
Yeah.
But I just... when you said how to take this forward, I just scheduled to go on a trip to Bhutan in December, and I'm kind of worried about the hiking and the altitude and all that kind of stuff. And anyway, I really appreciated your talk this morning because it helped me to kind of reframe my discomfort and anxiety about it. You know, and knowing that, like you said, we can dig deep and we can do it. And having completed the trip after that Yampa River trip, which was a big challenge that I did as well, a 3-week trek through snow and rain and sleet and all kinds of things I didn't expect in May. We've all got what it takes.
Thank you. It's so nice to see you today, too. Thank you. Who else? Yes. Yeah. Tell me your name, please.
My name is Bruce.
Bruce.
I very much appreciated your talk.
Thank you.
I very much appreciate the wilderness things you talked about. I have many experiences in the wilderness which have been life-changing. And so we have a saying in our family that whatever you plan on happening will not happen.
Exactly.
And that has served us very, very well because it keeps everybody in a positive space. And so.
And when it does, hallelujah, right?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And it's better. Or
yeah.
You say it's better. So
yeah.
Anyway, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you. Who else? Yeah, Andrew. It's nice to see you again. Thank you.
I was curious, when did you feel like you failed at being in the moment? You know, because that must happen.
It does happen. I'll tell you, when I was struggling with being so cold, that I knew that in my role as the Dharma teacher there and the convener of this trip, that I was struggling to manage my deep discomfort and at the same time being there for other people who were really uncomfortable. That's a real rub of how do I manage my own incredible discomfort in this. And some of it was just not you know, some of the being fully present with it was being able to say, I am really uncomfortable too. Or one evening we sat down for meditation after dinner, and within 5 minutes it started to rain. And I said, good night, everybody. Like that. You know, the being fully present with, why would we sit out in the rain freezing cold and meditate? Go to bed.
Did you ever fall into, like, the cheerleader role?
Did I, Linda?
That would be my MO.
What was I saying? I don't know. Was that before we went down that rapid and I was trying to stay warm? I was standing up. I was dancing because I was really cold. And what happens when you get to a big rapid is that the guides will typically scout it. You know, they'll go up to a place that's above it so they can really see. And this can take 10, 20 minutes, and it was cold. So I was just like, I stood there and I danced the whole time because it made me warmer. So I think that I didn't try to make it other than it was. I just said, yeah, I'm with you. I am really cold too. And look where we are. It's really beautiful. Because you know what? I think when we're real with each other, we also give each other the confidence that we can do it. I couldn't be other than that. I was freezing. Yeah. What else? Yeah.
I wanted to bring up the thing about protecting ourselves as protecting others.
Yeah.
And I had a conversation with some friends yesterday about when you're going through a very difficult challenge and you can say, well, there's always lightness in the darkness. There's always some light. But there are times when people don't feel the light. There's times when people don't even want you to say there's light because it's so dark for them. And I was just wondering what your thoughts would be as far as protecting others, what would you do in a situation like that?
Be as empathic as I could to say, you're right, it's really dark. I think that part of that teaching of caring for, I like to change the language from protecting others to caring for others. Caring for myself, I'm caring for others. Or protecting myself, I protect others. When we have the courage to say, you're right, it is really dark. And this is what it's like right now. We are not dismissing somebody else's experience at all. We're actually deeply caring for them by allowing that darkness, that pain, that struggle to be true. Because we so often can't tolerate somebody else's discomfort, their pain. And so we offer advice, right? We offer, how can I fix this? How can I change it? Because we're uncomfortable with that other person's difficulty. But when we can just purely be fully present and feel our hearts and not have an agenda, what that does is that person who is in pain lets their pain be held in a greater way. Because we're helping to hold their pain. We don't have to say, oh honey, it's temporary, it's going to get better. We can just say, right now it's like this. And we're just going to feel the this. Is that helpful?
Very much. Thank you.
You're welcome. Anybody else?
One thing I've learned. My husband and I were big hikers and kayakers, and boy, if I, and skiers, and you get in problematic situations, and finally in one ski trip I didn't want to hike with the group, I mean ski, because I was getting slower and my fear was coming up. So I ended up in the top of the mountain someplace I'd never been. So I thought, okay, separate my emotions and use your head because that's important. And I have used this in kayaking over and over again in a difficult thing. I don't know whether that has anything to do with what you're talking about, but it allowed me, you can feel all those emotions later, but right now, mm-hmm. you make a plan, mm-hmm. and I felt more comfortable then that I could handle it, and I did. But living through the last year of his life, which is three quarters of a year watching him die,
yeah.
was the toughest thing I've ever experienced. But I couldn't hold it, and I burst into tears, and then I take a walk, and I thought, I will endure. And I said it to me, and right now, as I try to learn to be a widow, and I miss him every day, but I will endure, and I have created a new life for myself. But somehow, if you can suppress the emotions and say, I will take care of them later, it allows you, at least for me, to move on.
First thing, I know this has been really hard, and I really enjoy getting to see you every time that I'm here.
Thank you.
And I do think you're right about enduring. And that teaching from Suzuki Roshi that says, what is the most important thing? To find out what is the most important thing. That's that piece when you're on top of the mountain where you have to say, yeah, this is scary, but actually I have to think about what I'm going to do right here. And you're right. So what happens is the decision-making acuity, that capacity has to take front seat. That's being fully present. We know it's hard. We know there's fear. We know there's anxiety. But you're right. I got to deal with that later because right now I have to work this out. And that same piece of, this is really painful. I can do hard things and I will endure and my heart is aching.
Right.
That's true too. So these are really two different ways of experiencing that, right?
Right.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up.
Thanks for your information today. That was wonderful. I want to go on that rafting trip with my daughter. I'm only 87. She said, Mom, you're not going to do it. I would have died in the cold.
Next year, September 6th, on the Colorado River.
September should be warm.
It's going to be warm. So, okay. Let's just go inside for 1 minute and seal this a little bit quiet. Settling into the body and just feel your breath. Settling in. And we'll end with a sweet poem from Jane Kenyon called Coming Home at Twilight in Late Summer. We turned into the drive and gravel flew up from the tires like sparks from a fire. So much to be done, the unpacking, the mail and papers, the grass needed mowing. We climbed stiffly out of the car and shut off engine ticked as it cooled. And then we noticed the pear tree, the limbs so heavy with fruit, they nearly touched the ground. We went out to the meadow. Our steps made black holes in the grass, and we each took a pear and ate and were grateful. May all beings everywhere be peaceful and safe and happy, come to the end of suffering, and may we care for ourselves and each other, and as we care for each other, knowing that we're cared for by others and for ourselves. Thank you so much for being here. On the back table, if you'd like to be on my email mailing list, you can sign up. There are also a couple of flyers for upcoming events. And I will be back the end of September. So see you then. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.